some of the themes that we started in on the workshop this morning. I know most of you actually are from the workshop, about some recent progress in understanding the generic differences between explanations of cosmic acceleration that is detected in supernovae, distance versus redshift measurements that imply missing matter energy or dark energy versus a modification to gravity, something in the infrared that we don't understand about gravity on the cosmological scales. And what I want to tell you mainly about is the progress in understanding how the different observations will, from the upcoming surveys, will come into testing models that actually have some hope of working. They're still toy models, but models that reproduce gravity on small scales, returning general relativity for the tests in the solar system. So here's the outline. I want to say a few words about the generic differences between dark energy and modified gravity, first highlighting the similarities that, in fact, if I told you nothing about what is dark energy, the microphysics of dark energy, I could not tell you the difference between changing the force laws and changing the energy, matter energy content. That is, I can always think of a dark energy component on either the left or the right hand side of the gravitational field equations. And if I didn't tell you anything about the microphysics of dark energy, we'd be stuck. That is, solar system tests are very precise because we have an idea of what the stress energy tensor dominates in the solar system. That is, we have the sun. But if I didn't tell you anything about what the energy stress energy tensor was, I couldn't tell you that I could distinguish modified gravity from dark energy. That is more of a philosophical degeneracy, and I'll tell you why our ideas of dark energy break that degeneracy. That is, we think that the dark energy is spatially smooth on scales that are small compared with the current horizon, and that breaks the degeneracy between modifying forces and adding matter energy content. So to develop that, I want to give you some toy examples, and I really mean that they're toy. I don't want to say that they're at the level of an explanation of cosmic acceleration, but I want to show you that from an action, you can write down a theory where you can work out the effects on expansion rate, the effects on horizon scale structure, the effects on large-scale structure of the universe, and the effects in the nonlinear regime through n-body simulations. And it's important to have this framework in mind, even going beyond these toy models. That is, if we wanted to have a gravitational explanation of cosmic acceleration that satisfies what we know about gravity, we had better be able to satisfy solar system tests of gravity. You better have some way of returning in the nonlinear regime the predictions of general relativity. So it's important to have that framework in mind in putting the tests together, things like the cluster abundance of the universe, the rare objects in the universe, gravitational lensing. They're all in the quasi-nonlinear to nonlinear regime, and how you make this transition back to general relativity is important. And here are my collaborators. I highlighted in yellow the ones that were students when they did the work, and a lot of them are represented here. I think Fabian is yet to arrive, but he's giving a talk hopefully this afternoon, and he'll be telling you about the DGP side of this. Okay, so standard handle. There we go. Someone doesn't like my slide because I have a joke here. Okay, so to remind you that most of the tests of cosmic acceleration come from geometric measurements, charting out the expansion rate as a function of redshift through either standard candles or standard rulers. And the joke here is usually I have headlights here, which are standard candles, and the distance between headlights as your standard ruler, judging as a distance measure, as a way of measuring distances, because you have some feel for the intrinsic brightness of a car and the distance between your two headlights. Those are basically the two ways that we get at the expansion rate of the universe. The joke here is that usually it's a deer in the headlights. Here it's BlackBerry in the headlights of the iPhone, with lambda being the peculiar thing that's pointing at you. So the two techniques, the first, the discovery was from supernovae, standard candles. and later confirmed by standard rulers, sound waves from microwave background, from WMAP, boomerang, etc., and from baryon acoustic oscillation, knowing a fixed physical scale and measuring the angular scale that is obtained as a measure of the distance to the observed galaxy, or the observed CMB in that case. But these are just telling us about the expansion rate of the universe. And as we heard this morning, if we just did that, we would have plenty of alternate explanations of what could be causing the acceleration of the expansion. That is, we have to probe a little deeper in cosmology to get at what is the physics behind cosmic acceleration. That is, the question for this colloquium is whether cosmic acceleration is a Mercury or a Pluto, if you would like to put it that way. That is it something where we have to tweak the laws of gravity in a regime that we haven't yet tested them in the infrared, in the very, very large scales? Or is it missing energy, missing planet, missing dark energy? So what we'd like to keep, because it's well tested, is the geometric properties of gravity. So I will stay within the framework of a metric theory of gravity. And what I'm going to be mainly talking about is modifications to the field equation, that is, how matter energy changes the geometry. The geometry gives you the expansion rate. And could the cosmic acceleration not be missing energy? Could it be an incomplete understanding of how matter energy sources geometry? So let me tell you about this formal degeneracy first. So what makes tests of gravity so incisive is if you know the stress energy content of your test, whether it's a laboratory test or the solar system, then you can test the force laws and field equations from the motion of bodies. But if I didn't tell you anything about the stress energy content of your laboratory experiment, in this case the whole universe, then there's a formal equivalency that says that I can just shift anything on the left-hand side that modifies the geometric part of the field equation and just place it on, it's my Canadian hockey stick, on the right-hand side of the equation and call it a missing stress energy. And the Bianchi identity, keeping it a metric theory, says that nicely this fake dark energy is covariantly conserved, is locally conserved. So it looks like, if I didn't give you anything about the microphysics, it looks like a valid component of the universe. It looks like something that conserves the Bianchi identity by the geometry of this construction and interpreting as a stress energy. It is a local conservation law.
It matters. So in principle, the sum of
that's right. So buried in this statement could be relationships. So this is always true. So it looks decoupled in this sense, that it's separately conserved. But that doesn't close the system, as you all know, that the microphysics closes the system, and the microphysics that closes the system might involve something to do with the metric generated by, say, dark matter and baryons.
No, but I don't quite understand. Where do you get that statement, that divergence of T mu nu dark energy is zero?
That the divergence of G mu nu is zero by the Bianchi identity. So I'm just saying that given that I want a geometric theory for gravity, that says that whatever I've done is covariantly conserved.
So you're assuming that dark energy doesn't interact with, well, not
no, so this represents an F of R theory, which in the Einstein frame looks like an interacting dark matter or dark energy theory.
Actually, so fine.
Yeah. I can do a conformal transformation where this looks like a coupled dark energy dark matter model. Okay. So the basic point is it requires microphysics. So conservation isn't enough to tell me what the physics is. And usually that's supplied by equations of state, that is, relationships between the components of the stress energy tensor, the pressure, the energy density, and the momentum density. Those are what an equation of state give you. And that's the thing where these toy models of modified gravity give you different relationships as the closure relationship. It's not that you can't think of it as a separate stress energy tensor that's covariantly conserved. It's that the microphysics that give you the closure relationships to make this a complete system that you can solve for the matter and the metric, and then have the matter move in the metric,
requires additional relationships that tell you the microphysics. And the microphysics of dark energy models and modified gravity models are very different. So let me elaborate on that. So modified gravity does not look like dark energy that are models that we know of, things like scalar fields that are decoupled from the dark matter. In other words, phenomenologically, the dark energy models provide an equation of state that's relativistic, that has a gene stability scale that is of order the horizon, a sound speed that is of order one. And so on small scales, the dark energy looks spatially smooth compared with the dark matter by its microphysics closure relationships, in this case, the Klein-Gordon equation, the wave equation for a scalar field, if you want dark energy to be a scalar field. And also that being spatially smooth, it has no anisotropy in its stress tensor. So not only does it have pressure fluctuations that are of order plus the energy density fluctuations, so stable, it has vanishingly small off diagonals in the stress energy tensor, and that will be important for distinguishing it from modified gravity explanations, which typically, if you interpret them as an additional stress energy tensor, would give you off diagonals in the effective stress energy tensor, as we'll see. So to put a little more framework onto it, if we take, it's a geometric theory, so if we write down a gauge where you have the metric defined by the two Newtonian-like potentials, the gene stability says that this Poisson equation that comes out for non-relativistic motion in small scales compared with the horizon would be that the metric fluctuation is just sourced by the matter density fluctuation, the dark energy density fluctuations being much smaller on small scales than the matter density fluctuations means that their effects only come by changing the expansion rate of the universe. And that's the key consistency check that is proposed in testing smooth dark energy models, that if you have a smooth dark energy component, it's only affecting the growth of structure through its effect on the background expansion. Accelerating the background expansion means that matter gravitationally is going to slow down in its clumping because the universe is expanding too quickly. Okay. And the other key point in understanding the difference between dark energy and modified gravity relationships, is to think about the other combination of these two metric potentials. That is, if I took the plus combination of the space and time piece here, that's sourced by the anisotropic stress by just general relativity and some unknown form of dark energy. The anisotropic stress would produce differences in the Keplerian mass, which is non-relativistic particles would feel the time piece of the metric. And so when I'm looking at the dynamics of non-relativistic particles, I would be testing this, right? It has a difference between the dynamical mass and the mass that goes into Lagrangian, or the mass that is felt by gravitational lensing, which sees both components, both the time and space piece. And that's the leading order difference that you want to measure if you're testing dark energy or modified gravity explanations for cosmic acceleration. So in case I forget to define it later, this thing is the relevant thing to look at, the ratio between the stuff generated by the anisotropic stress and the stuff generated by density fluctuations, which I'll call little g. It's also related to the parameterized post-Newtonian parameter that you measure in the solar system, and there it's called gamma. Okay, so with the assumption of dark energy being smooth, then dark energy makes very, very strong falsifiable predictions for the growth of structure that can be tested in a variety of observations that are upcoming. So we have the things that best test the acceleration right now are geometric measurements. Forgot to add the CMB here, but supernovae, baryonic acoustic oscillations, measuring the local expansion rate through the Hubble constant measurements, tell us about the expansion rate of the universe. And we know that if the dark energy is smooth, that its effect on the growth of structure in the universe, the gravitational growth of structure, can only come through the expansion rate itself. So that provides a consistency relationship that if you constrain these geometric properties of the expansion rate, you predict what you should see in other observations. This has predictive power for the upcoming observations of looking at rare objects, clusters of galaxies, their abundance, weak gravitational lensing, looking at how much shearing of distant galaxies the intervening matter produces, and also velocity field measurements, looking at the dynamics of gravitational collapse, looking at the velocity field of galaxies through redshift space distortions that we heard a lot about in Jeff Newman's talk this morning. So how good is the current data in this vein? So this is something that Dragan Huderer will be talking about, joint work with Dragan, in his talk, I think, tomorrow morning. So this is sort of a preview of that. And this is to say that even the current data on the geometry side is very, very, very predictive on the growth side. You can take that either way, that the growth measurements are lagging the geometry measurements, or you can take it in a positive way, that it's making a very strong falsifiable prediction for what the next generation observations of those growth probes should see, and an opportunity to certainly falsify a cosmological constant. If it's a cosmological constant, then it can vary from these predictions, even currently, by more than about 2% at one sigma. So the error bar is about 2% on the growth of structure, which is this little g, compared with the maximum likelihood model for a cosmological constant today. The somewhat more surprising thing here might be that if I took the whole class of scalar field cosmologies, any potential I wanted, well, that statement weakens, but only weakens in one direction, because a canonical kinetic term for a scalar field is bounded by -1 in its equation of state, the pressure over the energy density. And so it's one-sided from lambda CDM. That is, in terms of the growth of structure, it can only suppress the growth of structure intervening between the microwave background at high redshift and today. And it can never enhance it. So if you ever see an excess in any of these statistics, more clusters than you would expect from lambda CDM, more gravitational lensing than you would expect from lambda CDM by this 2% level, then it can't even be a scalar field. It can't be a canonical kinetic term scalar field that is decoupled from the dark matter, that has no coupling to dark matter. There are other predictions that I think Dragan will go through in terms of things that are predicted better than they're measured, and that includes the Hubble constant. So the Hubble constant is also a great opportunity to falsify both a cosmological constant and all of quintessence if it turns out to be higher than 72-ish kilometers per second per megaparsec that the maximum likelihood cosmological constant model gives you. Those are the 95% limits. Since it's asymmetric, we wanted to show both. This is current data.
Yeah. WMAP plus
union plus Baran acoustic oscillations, LRG, plus the shoes, H naught. This is a principal component analysis with 10 principal components for the equation of state. Dragan will say this in great detail. So this is mainly an advertisement that if you're interested, you should go see Dragan's talk. Okay. And this is to remind you what the observations are, looking at the rarest objects in the universe, the clusters of galaxies, looking at the shearing distortion of faint galaxies by the gravitational lensing of the intervening matter, looking at gravitational potentials through the microwave background, photons traveling in and out of gravitational potential wells, and looking at velocity flows through redshift surveys, looking at galaxy surveys for their velocity content.
Is only in you have to compare two measures.
Right.
Now,
so
can we just
comparing the CMB amplitude?
So can we actually compare just one single metric loci to CMB?
Absolutely. Anything here would falsify lambda or any redshift.
So single redshift measurement can actually do this in principle.
That's
if you compare to CMB.
Yeah. So that is a good point in the sense that we can control our systematics much, much better with local tests. And I'll show you the local cluster abundance through Alexi's Chandra sample is the best constraint on one of the modified gravity theories right now. And likewise, in this context, if you wanted to go for one measurement that falsifies the cosmological constant, perhaps you want to hammer down on H-naught, right? Because we know how to control systematics in a local distance measurement. Okay. So, you will hear in the next few years many claims that gravity is wrong and we need a modification to gravity. I will tell you not to believe them offhand, but let me tell you what are the sorts of things that would violate these predictions. So if you saw a larger number of massive high redshift clusters or any redshift clusters through any of these upcoming observations, X-ray observations of clusters, Sinyaev-Zoldovich observations of clusters, and you were willing to assume Gaussian initial conditions from inflation, you would rule out all of quintessence, all of the scalar field models with canonical kinetic terms and no couplings would be ruled out if you saw a significant excess over what you expect from lambda CDM. And as we heard this morning, there are certainly claims that you do have very high mass, very high redshift clusters. But I will give you the cautionary note that these are astrophysics measurements. The key to that one is how massive. So you really need a very, very good lower bound on how massive they are to apply a test like this. And also whether you, which is the next part of the talk, whether you would expect this sort of violation of a modified gravity theory is also something you want to be aware of. And it turns out, no, you would not expect and a generic modification that explains cosmic acceleration at low redshift that you would have more impact on high redshift than you have on low redshift. But it would be a falsification of quintessence. You just wouldn't know what to replace it with. Likewise, you should see no excess in gravitational lensing anywhere, including high redshifts, and there's also been claims in the literature that we see excesses. So, beware. So in the next few years, there will certainly be many two-sigma violations of general relativity coming up, and you want to have multiple cross-checks, multiple tests that this is really a deviation in gravity and not a deviation in how well we understand the astrophysical systematics before you believe any one of them. And the next part is, if you falsify quintessence or a cosmological constant, falsify in favor of what? What are the sorts of things that we would expect to see if it were a modification to gravity and not dark energy? So here I have to start talking about specific models as examples instead of generic statements about what dark energy predicts. I need to give you a few examples of what modifications to gravity would predict. But the most typical thing that it gives you is a difference between the dynamical mass and the gravitational lensing mass. That is, think about this geometric argument about gravity. With non-relativistic particles, we're just seeing the time-time piece of the metric, the gravitational potential itself. Whereas in gravitational lensing, we know that Einstein told us that general relativity would say you'd multiply by a factor of two, or in other words, the space curvature is also important in the deflection of photons around a massive object. And if we modify the force law generically, we would expect to see some difference in this. And that's how tests in the solar system work. They test the difference between these two potentials and the deviations on the solar system scale have to be very, very small, 10 to the minus 5-ish. So the same goes for cosmology. That is, we have this geometric the idea that gravity is geometric, and we want to look for differences between
the dynamics of non-relativistic particles and relativistic particles. They're all following geodesics, but if we change our idea of gravity, we change the amount of space curvature that's generated per unit dynamical mass, per unit Keplerian mass. And beware of this. You will also see many two sigma deviations of this. So here's work by Tristan Smith. He would not say that this is a violation of gravity, I'm absolutely sure. But if you just took it literally and you tried to measure this ratio, which instead of little g is now just this ratio of the two potentials, just like it is in the solar system tests, gamma ppn is for parameterized post-Newtonian. If you literally interpret it without factoring in the systematic errors of looking at a comparison between strong gravitational lensing and dynamical mass from velocity dispersions in elliptical galaxies, you would get what you would think statistically is a violation of the general relativistic prediction. But again, the astrophysics, once you factor in the systematic errors from things like not knowing the mass profile of a galaxy, you broaden out this distribution to the point where it's consistent with general relativity. The other point, what's that?
What is the GR value for gamma ppn again?
One. That's in the tails of this statistics.
Right.
So I'm cautioning about two sigma. That is more than two sigma.
But it's less than three.
It's less than three. That's right.
And the other thing is that there's no mass trend. So in some of these models where you're hiding the extra forces in dense regions, you might expect a mass trend. But as I'll show you, there, and Fabian, I think, will show you explicit tests of this, the trend is too weak to actually be able to use these measurements. These are the actual measurements as a function of mass to really sharply constrain deviations in the force law that give you a different space curvature per unit dynamical mass. And also, we saw this morning, on larger scales, there's also this test. You can phrase it as a test of lensing mass versus dynamical mass, this time looking at gravitational lensing, weak gravitational lensing around galaxies, and looking at the dynamics from not velocity dispersion, but linear velocity flows. But the same idea applies. The linear velocity field is seeing the time-time piece of the metric, and gravitational lensing is seeing both the time-time piece and the space curvature, and you would generically expect a difference if you modified the force law. So here it's consistent with the general relativistic ratio. And it's getting at the level where it's starting to be an incisive test, cosmological test of this. So a test in a very different regime. Its precision is not anywhere near the solar system precision, but it is a unique test of the large-scale property of galaxies now in the linear regime, not in halos of galaxies. And we'll see that's very important, that the expectations in models which return general relativistic predictions on small scales would say that any of these effects are suppressed in a dark matter halo inside a galaxy.
Matter more. Yes, producing.
Yeah, we always have dark matter here, so I'm not trying to get rid of dark matter.
No, because right. I mean, how do you?
Right. This is large scales, mostly in the linear regime. So what I'm assuming here is that you have dark matter, you have baryons, and they're tracing each other. But yeah, those sorts of assumptions also go in. Right, I should have said that off the bat. I'm not trying to get rid of dark matter here. I'm just trying to explore.
Some of his own.
I know. Right, so I'm not touching any of that literature here. Okay. So that gives you an idea of what sort of generic thing we're trying to look for. But now let's be a little more incisive about the regimes where we can probe this. So if we see a falsification of any of those predictions that I showed you about smooth dark energy, and we have all of these astrophysics systematics, we want to see, falsify in favor of what? Is this likely to be explained by a change in force laws, or is this likely to be an astrophysics systematic? And there, it's important to remember that we have very good tests of gravity, especially locally. So if you're looking for some anomaly, if you're looking for an explanation of some anomaly that you see in the data, and you're wondering whether it's likely to be gravity, you should check that whether this explanation can satisfy local tests of gravity, because they're very, very stringent. So in terms of this framework, I want to split it into three regimes for testing gravity from astrophysics. I want to talk about the very, very large scales, that is, we're trying to modify the expansion rate of the universe. So the horizon scale stuff, the stuff on the scale of the whole observable universe, had better be consistent with the background expansion. So basically, there's a consistency relation that says there's one less degree of freedom in what you can do on horizon scale, horizon scale structure than you can do on smaller scales. It has to obey, basically, Bianchi identity and conservation of stress energy imposes from a background expansion history what you can do with the fluctuations. And that is important even for our practical examples. That is the regime where BGP, the brain world self-accelerating example, runs into trouble. So that's where we see the biggest violations of that. In fact, not the solar system. We see it on the horizon scale as the biggest tension in the BGP case, and it's now reached about 5 sigma. And then there's a Newtonian regime, slow motion regime, where you have a small scale regime, where you have basically a scalar tensor regime. You have a scalar tensor theory of gravity, and that's where these tests, looking at the space curvature per unit dynamical mass, really apply. That's where we expect to see perhaps order unity deviations in that ratio. But on small scales, we know a lot about that ratio. It should be some very, very small deviation to satisfy solar system tests of gravity. And so in any theory that has any hope of working, you had better have a nonlinear equation for this field, this extra field that mediates these extra forces. It sends you back to general relativity on small scale, and that makes it harder to test astrophysics in test deviations that are likely to explain cosmic acceleration in the very deeply non-relativistic regime, because we have to satisfy what we know about gravity, and that means in our galactic halo, gravity pretty much has to be normal. Okay. So in these two regimes, there's been a lot of work done. There's a lot of literature. I'm not citing everyone here. There's pretty much consensus on how we would deal with this in linear perturbations around a Friedman-Robertson-Walker metric. Our collaboration put together a package for our parameterization of it. We called it parameterized post-Friedman. The basic thing about this equivalence between dark energy and modified gravity is it allows you to use all the tools that normal cosmologists use with general relativity for modified gravity, because you can always phrase it as an equivalence so long as you close the relationships in the stress energy tensor in a way appropriate for the modified gravity theories. In this case, again, the leading thing is the amount of space curvature generated per unit dynamical mass. So that's the one parameter. And there's a second closure parameter that is the thing that various authors differ on in terms of their choice. And motivated by the models that I will tell you a little bit about, the cleanest way to do it is the relationship between the lensing mass and the things in the Lagrangian, the masses that you would put in the Lagrangian. So that was our choice. And if you want to use it, there's a nice CAM package to do all of the linear theory by Wenzhong Fang. It's publicly available. I should note it's also useful for other things. It's also useful for dark energy, things that have wrong sign kinetic terms and cross the phantom, the -1 divide for the dark energy. And it's useful for any model that does do that, which Dragan will tell you about tomorrow. And it's useful for thinking about alternate other models of gravity that I won't talk about.
All right, so here's a pictorial view of three regimes that I want to spend the rest of my time on. The large scales, where there's a consistency relationship between wanting to modify the expansion history of the universe for cosmic acceleration and what you predict for large-scale observables in the microwave background, namely, and its correlation with galaxies. There's a linear scalar tensor regime where you have Newtonian-like physics with just a difference between the space curvature generated per unit dynamical mass. And there's a non-relativistic regime where you have non-linearities in these deviations, a reproduced general relativity to satisfy solar system constraints. All right.
At the same time, so
I just mean the gamma has to be forced to one, so it's post-Newtonian, but post-Newtonian with a small post-Newtonian parameter. Okay, so we found it very useful in our group to think about worked models where you can write down an action and try to work out all the predictions, including all the way to the nonlinear regime through standard techniques like n-body simulations. So the two that I want to throw up is the toy models. And the way I'm using toy models, I would include all of quintessence as a toy model. None of this is well motivated from the particle physics side. We're using it to explore what our observations, our great upcoming observations of the expansion rate and the growth of structure can tell us about generic theories that are yet to be invented. But it's still useful to think about specific models to see how this spectrum works, this going from very small-scale general relativistic predictions all the way to an accelerating background. So one of the simplest things that you could try doing is modifying the action from the Einstein-Hilbert action, because basically lambda is a modification of the action as Einstein thought of it, an addition on the left-hand side of the field equation. So if I just put a constant there, that would be a cosmological constant. And various people, starting with Starobinsky and thinking about how this might cause inflation and accelerate the background with at high curvature, high Ricci scalar, how it could cause cosmic acceleration. And then some work after the supernovae discovery of cosmic acceleration at low curvatures, people came up with the idea that maybe this deviation is strongest when the Ricci scalar gets small instead of when the Ricci scalar gets large, now not motivated from any particle physics, but a phenomenological attempt to explain cosmic acceleration. And basically, I don't want to get into the math very much, but just I want to say that in action you can write down the field equations, and the important things are the first derivative of this function with respect to the Ricci scalar, which I'll sometimes call the scalar, the field that's going in to modifying the force law, the range of that extra scalar, and this is an extra force above normal gravity, that's an attractive force. You want to know the range of that force, so the second derivative gives you essentially the mass of this extra scalar and the propagation length, the Compton wavelength. And sometimes I will phrase that in terms of the one ruler we have in the cosmological sense, the Hubble scale. So B is that Compton wavelength over the Hubble scale squared. So basically, you can do the field equations. The bottom line is you can write it down, and you can take the trace, and the trace of this little f sub r thing obeys a Klein-Gordon-like equation. So it looks like an extra scalar that is now coupled to the dark matter density, as we were talking about before. And that makes it appealing because there is a known mechanism for how to suppress these extrascalar forces by putting in a potential where the mass term in a high-density region gets very large and suppresses the range of the force and suppresses the deviations from gravity, from normal gravity. So that's the important thing to look at, the range of this force, first in the background, and then in terms of how it gets more massive in local structures. The key to the F of R is that it depends on how deep the gravitational potential is. So in a deep gravitational potential well, the mass term gets large and the extra field gets suppressed.
The only truly stable theory of this kind is when f of r equals r.
Then there are tachyonic instabilities that you have to cure by choosing the right sign of this. So the original models were all tachyonically unstable. The ones I'll talk about are stable in that sense. So because I can write this as two second order equations, so you're saying that this is a fourth order equation in the metric, right? But I can write this down as two second order equations, and so long as the mass term is positive, there's no instability of that sort. Now, in constructing the model of f of r, you can construct a model that hits a curvature singularity. There's a different sort of instability there. So, you know, at high curvature, you perhaps have to worry. But I'm going to stay in the Newtonian region. I'm just going to talk about things in the slow motion Newtonian regime.
So you don't run into trouble with the Ostrogresky theorem.
There's no ghosts or anything in this model.
This is a specific one.
I'll show you a specific model.
One question. So you're describing a scalar field coupled to the trace of the stress energy tensor. But these FOP theories are a particular set of models. So there is a motivation why one stick to it instead of studying a generic scalar field coupled to
Optimum. So the motivation is that in Jordan's brain it looks like a modification. You mean if I wanted to change the coupling constants?
Yeah. So why?
Yes, I can do that. Yeah.
One other point, Jordan Brand-Stickin, you only get gamma equal to 1 with extreme fine tuning in the solar system.
Yeah, so there is a small parameter in the theory that I will say is consistent with solar system tests. That small parameter is at the level of 10 to the minus 5 to 10 to the minus 6 compared with what you would naturally think it is. So basically, the scale in this problem would naturally be the Hubble scale. So I usually want to have a mass that's so light that the quantum wavelength is bordered the Hubble scale, just like you would in quintessence. And it turns out that solar system tests would make this have to be less than a few kiloparsecs.
But there are papers showing that even if you put in a massive ground sticking, you still don't get gamma equal to 1. But then the ground sticking coupling would tend to be 5.
Yeah, so that's where scaling comes in. So we have a potential that is a non-trivial function of the field, and that's different from Brand-Sticky. Maybe it'll become clearer as I go on. speed up. The other example is the brain world acceleration model from DGP, where we're on a brain and in an extra dimension having a bulk with different strengths of gravity in the brain and the bulk with a crossover scale so that on large scales on the brain gravity looks five-dimensional. On small scales it looks four-dimensional with a scalar tensor regime in intermediate scales and a nonlinear mechanism called the Weinstein mechanism that returns ordinary gravity on in high-density regimes. And this is the crucial difference between this and f of r, that it's high density that returns general relativity, not deep potentials. Basically, some of the history about solving perturbations in this, which I think Bobby and Schmidt will tell you a lot more about than I can, convince you that it's actually, in principle, hard work to do even the linear theory calculation. But in the background, it becomes simple. You have two branches, one which, as the density goes away from the expansion, gives you self-acceleration, the other giving you acceleration only if you add in an extra component of dark energy, some brain tension, or explicit dark energy like a scalar field. So I show you this because it seems very complicated. We have to follow perturbations out into the bulk to do this. There we go. Here's a picture of the brain on the self-accelerating branch and the normal branch. There's even ways to shortcut across the bulk. But everything on the brain on large scales is controlled by having the Bianchi identity being obeyed and covariant conservation of the matter stress energy tensor giving you covariant conservation of whatever you assign to this extra stress energy tensor is. And that means that you get a very simple description. So, for example, on the normal branch, this ratio of the space curvature generated by
Keplerian mass comes out to be very simple in terms of the Hubble parameter and the crossover scale, at least on scales that are observable. And we've used this to use the cosmological data today to constrain what the crossover scale is. I should say it's curious that in the deep de Sitter regime, this actually changes. So if we waited long enough, even at a very large crossover scale compared with the horizon today, which is the horizon which in de Sitter would end up as very close to the Hubble constant in de Sitter, even with very small deviations, you would see fairly dramatic effects in the very, very late time behavior of this, but they're not testable. Okay, so to keep on going with this, you can engineer an FFR model to satisfy solar system tests and satisfy a background acceleration and expansion. Basically, we want to have something which at low curvature doesn't have an explicit cosmological constant, at high curvature returns ordinary gravity, something that would satisfy that has a form like this, which drawing it out looks like this. At very low curvatures, it goes away. At high curvatures, it becomes a constant. It looks very much like a cosmological constant. So that's a reverse engineer of taking what we know about the observations and saying, if we wanted it to be a modified action model, what would it look like? Starobinsky also has a version that looks almost identical to this. And the expansion history, you can get cosmic acceleration. No surprise there. I have something that, for a very large range in curvature, looks like a constant, looks like a cosmological constant. So in that sense, easy to get background acceleration. The somewhat disappointing thing is if you want to satisfy solar system tests, you have this fine-tuning issue that the deviations on the expansion rate are going to be very, very small to satisfy solar system constraints. So if this is the correct model for modified gravity explanations of cosmic acceleration, you would never see it in supernovae measurements or baryon acoustic oscillation measurements unless you got to 10 to the minus 5. But no survey that's been proposed could possibly reach that. In DGP, the story is different. So in the self-accelerating branch, you get sizable deviations from the cosmological constant equation of state, if you think of this as an effective dark energy. And that's part of the story why you have a problem with the observations. You can fit it to supernovae. You can try to fit it to the cosmic microwave background, but there's only one parameter in this model, the crossover scale. So even at the geometric level, there's tension in the data in the sense that you would have to throw in spatial curvature to try to have even the expansion history right compared with the microwave background and supernovae. And the normal branch, you throw in an explicit dark energy or cosmological constant. It doesn't have to be a brain tension. It could be dynamical if you want. But basically, you can still think about this as a test of gravity in the infrared. You give up that it is the explanation for cosmic acceleration. And the nice thing is that this one is ghost-free. The self-accelerating branch is a ghost, which makes it, that's why I said it was a toy model, a way of understanding how the observations fit into a modification of gravity. All right, so three regimes, conserved curvature regime. Don't want to dwell much on it, but basically the background expansion history, which is the Hubble parameter as a function of redshift or scale factor, and covariant conservation of stress energy gives you what you get in normal gravity, which is the curvature is conserved, the co-moving curvature, the curvature on co-moving slices is conserved, which translating into our metric says that there is an equation that you have to satisfy, even though these in GDP say the perturbations are propagating out into the bulk. And in FFR, it's a fourth order theory in terms of the metric, still has to satisfy this very simple equation. And the one degree of freedom is, again, that relationship between space curvature and the Newtonian potential or the Keplerian mass versus the gravitational lensing mass. Once you know that, it's a closed system. There's only one degree of freedom on large scales that you need to parameterize for the metric. that tells you, given a background expansion history, what you should see in the microwave background, for example, through the change in the potential and how photons travel in and out. So in the F of R case, you have an enhancement of forces, so you have the gravitational potentials changing by growing, and that you can observe in things like the microwave background, where you observe photons going in and out of a large-scale structure of the universe. If the gravitational potential is changing, in this case decaying, as the photon is traversing it, it will get a net differential redshift or blue shift that leads to an anisotropy on very large scales. So in F of R, you can have growing potentials, and you can cancel out the suppression that you would get with a cosmological constant having a decaying potential, so you could lower the multiples at low L. But you have to be able to satisfy our other tests of this effect, that is the correlation between galaxies and the microwave background, and that, in fact, rules out the ability to flatten that spectrum there. So basically, the qualitative thing is we see a correlation between galaxies and the microwave background, and if you had gravitational potentials growing because there was an extra force with a Compton wavelength that was quite large, and you can see it on the horizon scale, you would have an excess in the gravitational potential, but a reversal in the sign of the cross-correlation with galaxies, and that would be a qualitative failure of a model like that. If you do the calculation with all of the data, recent paper by Lucas Lumbreiser et al., including Andre Slozar, the constraint goes down to about half squared of the Compton wavelength over the Hubble, the scale of the range of the extra force versus the scale of the universe squared. So it is testing things with extra forces of the range of the whole horizon, the bottom line of that. In DGP, you have the opposite effect. You have the propagation of these perturbations into the bulk, enhancing the decay of gravitational potentials. That's what's causing the biggest tension of the data right now. That is, if we wanted to get a model that fitted the supernovae, you would produce a large excess in the first 10 multiples of the microwave background anisotropy. So combined, either you think of it as the supernovae constraining our crossover scale and predicting the microwave background having an excess, or the other way around, the microwave background forcing you to have a larger RC than you would want for the supernovae. Either way you want to think of it, it's reaching 5 sigma. It is 5 sigma in terms of attention, and that is purely coming from the horizon scale regime, this regime of gravity that is beyond the scalar tensor Newtonian regime. Okay, and this is just to demonstrate that there's no way to fix this. Even if you truncated the initial power spectrum to try to reduce the large scale power, you couldn't do that without truncating the polarization of the microwave background on the same scales. WMAP observation up here says that you can't do that. You can do a normal branch, because in the normal branch you put in a cosmological constant or a brain tension. There you're constraining this crossover scale, and now the crossover scale has to be greater than 3 times the current horizon at 95% confidence. All right, so how much time? Okay. So I will skip over most of the scalar tensor regime, and you should go to the talks of the meeting where this is very, very well covered, including our morning talks. Basically, in the scalar tensor regime, you have an extra contribution that distinguishes between the space curvature and the Newtonian potential. So you have a Poisson-like equation for the thing that gravitational lensing tests, and the dynamics of non-relativistic particles sees a modification that looks like an effective G Newton on this. What I want to really focus on in the last few minutes is on this final regime, where you have to have a mechanism to return ordinary gravity. So many of the extrapolations of what future surveys will give us have been assuming that you have this all the way down to small scales, and that is not a theory that would satisfy what we know about gravity already. So how does a model like that work? Well, really, the distinction between these two potentials, the gravitational lensing potential and the dynamical potential, is mediated by an extra scalar in these scalar tensor theories. But in this regime, we're linearizing the fluctuations in the scalar. And if it satisfies some nonlinearity that sets this extra source to the deviation to zero in some high density or high potential, deep potential region, then you can recover, you can suppress this extra force, and you can recover what we know about gravity in those regimes. So linear theory, excess forces, and probe it through the dynamics of galaxies. This is what happens to the velocity field of galaxies, and you can use that as the dynamical mass to test against lensing mass, the deflection of photons around galaxies. And that was, again, the data. So now let's talk about this nonlinear regime. All right, so here it is again. This is the sort of structure we have. And this is amenable to n-body simulation. So if I have a specific idea of what this nonlinearity is, right, I can, it's a metric theory of gravity. So if I know how to evolve this extra scalar through this nonlinear equation, I know how to get the metric out, and everything's falling on geodesics of the metric, with one caveat that I'll let Lam tell you about. I have a slide on that, but I'm sure I'm not going to have time to talk about it. You can solve this by n-body techniques. That is, it looks like something where you have particles moving in a gravitational potential. Just as usual, you need to modify the field equations to account for some extra scalar that obeys a nonlinear function of the field. In terms of f of r, it is something that you can express as a potential where the mass term is changing as a function of the field, and the field is sourced by gravitational potentials, and you can change the field enough in a deep gravitational potential to make the mass very large and suppress the range of the extra force. In the brain world example, and generalized to Galilean type models where you have a symmetry in terms of the derivative structure of this interaction, you can have this Weinstein mechanism in a high density regime. In fact, you have extra derivatives here that look kind of like a Poisson equation. Say that in this sort of mechanism, it's the density that you want to look at and not the potential. So in the f of r case, this little argument says that the change in the field is sourced by the gravitational potential. So in a deep gravitational potential, you can move the field enough. So in the potential of the field, you can change the mass to be very large, from a very small cosmological value to a very large value inside a dark matter halo. And this is a little bit about the technique. Fabian will tell you a lot more about this. N-body code, we're using a particle mesh scheme solved for the field through this nonlinear relaxation to get the solution of the nonlinear field equations. That's the hard part. Everything else is normal. Once you get the field, you get the gravitational potential, and you move the particles just by non-relativistic Newtonian-like mechanics. Okay, so here are some pictures of the bottom line. So here's an example of looking at the density field from an n-body simulation, the potential field of an n-body simulation, and this extra scalar force that we're modifying gravity with. What you should see here is that in deep gravitational potentials, you are moving the field a lot. So you're changing the field value from the background value a lot, which causes the mass term to get very large in these deep gravitational potentials and suppresses the range of the extra force called the chameleon mechanism. And the bottom line for where we are in terms of cosmological constraints versus solar system constraints is we need this to happen, right? We need this field to be suppressed in the galactic halo because of solar system tests of gravity. So solar system tests of gravity in these cosmological models basically is a constraint that gravity has to be normal inside the galactic halo. So it's not a statement about how precise we know the PPN parameter. It's a statement that we need the galaxy to be shielding the solar system. So the constraint is actually a constraint on what's happening in the galaxy level, not the solar system level. And in this model, this is what gives you this fine tuning. That is, if we had a large background field that gives you a long Compton wavelength, then the gradients that you would get from trying to bend the field and make it more massive inside a gravitational potential well costs too much energy. So the gradient energy exceeds the benefit you get from being at the minimum of scalar field potential, and the field remains stiff. So in this n-body, what you should see is as I raise the external field level, the field remains stiff, and in the centers of these galactic halos, you no longer have the suppression of the force. And that puts you somewhere between 10 to the minus 4 and 10 to the minus 6 in this small parameter of what the solar system tells us. And cosmology is sort of hovering at this level. So it's getting competitive with solar system tests, but not yet. This is running through some statistics. You can look at the power spectrum. Basically, we saw some things in this morning that were extrapolating from linear theory to nonlinear theory. These don't work in models where there's these nonlinear suppression of the extra force deviations, so be careful of doing that. And this is just to show you that all the deviations are suppressed on small scales compared with an extrapolation of what you would see in linear theory and a halo model type Smith et al. Extrapolation from that. All right, and you can see excesses in terms of the number of rare objects, clusters of galaxies. This is the so far the most powerful constraint on these modified action models. So we're here in the cosmological data right now. But as you go down to things that are competitive with solar system tests, things that actually pass the solar system tests, you see that I'm losing the discriminating power at high masses, the clusters of galaxies. And the best way to probe it is to look at groups of galaxies down here, because the chameleon mechanism and the deepest gravitational potential wells has already sent us back to ordinary gravity. And that's the solar system constraint. You have to shield us very, very well, which means that the thin shell has to be further out. Otherwise, you won't get 10 to the minus 5-ish deviations at 10 kiloparsecs. That's right. So this is work with Alexei Buchanan, and maybe we'll talk about later in the week. The cluster constraint is so far the most powerful constraint on this modified action model. Or is it magnitude better than the ISW constraint that I was showing you earlier?
Is already enhanced by having this
in this OR. In this case where the extra force is attractive.
So that's the extra force is attractive.
Right. In self-accelerating DGP, which Fabian will tell you a lot more about and embodied simulations of that, the sign is reversed on the self-accelerating branch. It's attractive on the normal branch and also on the self-accelerating branch. Same thing happens there, except it's the density field that generates it. This is important because in the galactic halo, we know the galactic halo is in a large local group, and the local group is in large-scale structure, so the gravitational potential is a lot less well-defined than the local density. So in terms of DGP, it's the local density that gives you most of this suppression effect. But you do have to be careful about things. You don't want to just modify G nu by some density-dependent factor. Otherwise, it will break things like what we might talk about, equivalence principle type tests. Anyway, this is a preview of Fabian's talk. You can do the same for the other leading mechanism for returning ordinary gravity, the Einstein mechanism. And this is what I was telling you about. Although the equivalence principle is, weak equivalence principle is satisfied in any of these metric theories, you have to worry about the self field of objects, essentially. So the motion of massive bodies in an external field has some interesting features, in mainly in the F of R model, but also potentially in the DGP model if you go inside the Weinstein radius. All right, so I'll leave it at that, mainly as a preview of some upcoming talks. So in terms of what we've learned about distinguishing modified gravity explanations of cosmic acceleration from dark energy, well, there's a formal degeneracy that if I told you nothing about what the dark energy is, I could not tell you that a given observation could not be reproduced by dark energy. So I can always construct a designer stress energy tensor that doesn't obey any reasonable microphysics that would give me the prediction of any of these modified gravity models. But if you put in some more physical structure to what you think the dark energy is, perhaps a scalar field, something that is smooth on scales that are inside the horizon, then there's a consistency relationship between the growth of structure and the background expansion that is already leading to very highly falsifiable predictions at the percent level. That is, we predict what we should see in tests like the abundance of clusters and in gravitational lensing. And if we see something that violates it at any redshift, any one redshift is enough, because it's using the long lever arm between the CMB and the local observations of the expansion rate. If you violate that, then it can't be a normal quintessence model with canonical kinetic term and no coupling with dark matter. So if those observations are falsified, what sort of things would be likely to indicate that we're having a modification of gravity? Well, basically, it's the amount of space curvature generated per unit dynamical mass, Keplerian mass, that is the thing that changes the most in a modified gravity model. But it changes in a way that differs in terms of what it implies for the observations on the three scales. On the large scales, it obeys a conservation of curvature type statement, which says that the background expansion history plus this one number, the amount of space curvature per unit dynamical mass, is enough to close the whole system and give you a prediction for the microwave background. If you work out that prediction for the self-accelerating DGP model, you get a problem where you cannot be compatible with both the microwave background structure stuff and the ISW effect and the supernova distance stuff simultaneously, and that's at a 5-sigma level with or without spatial curvature. You have an intermediate regime where it becomes a scalar tensor theory, and if your theory is conformally invariant, that is, it couples to the trace of the energy momentum tensor. You can think of this in Einstein or Jordan frame, but this conformal symmetry says that, again, the one thing you want to measure is this curvature per unit dynamical mass, and the relationship between density and Lensing mass is pretty much normal in those models. Very small deviations. On small scales, which is the most interesting thing in the area that still requires much work in terms of understanding generically how to test gravity, I can say that you must have some mechanism to return general relativity locally in our galactic halo, because the solar system tests are so precise that you can't tolerate a deviation inside the galactic halo. You can't tolerate an order unity change in this curvature per unit dynamical mass inside the galactic halo. So this is the one parameter that controls all three regimes, but in a very different way in all three regimes. The two mechanisms that have been worked out explicitly as toy models for cosmic acceleration are the modified action model and the plane world DGP or Galilean type models, where the nonlinear regime is determined either by the gravitational potentials in the modified action model or by the density field in the Weinstein mechanism. But you need some way of suppressing deviations, and the challenge for generic tests of gravity is, are these the only ways that do that, or are there other possibilities that could map us back to GR on small scales? These models where gravity is still geometric are amenable to standard n-body techniques. That is, once we solve for the metric, we know how to move the matter, and everything, all the tools go forward. That would be slightly different in a model where the couplings weren't universal and you have to have different forces for the baryon versus the dark matter. So in that sense, what I was saying about the coupling, this regime would also distinguish different models in that regime. Thank you.
Wayne, perhaps it's just an issue of how F sub R is defined. I was confused about, you know, the development Milky Way. We know the potential is about 10 to the minus 6. So naively one would say, well, F sub r should just be solar system that alone should be 10 to the minus 6.
Yeah, that is probably right.
That's whereas right. The constraint you were presenting was actually 10 to minus 5.
Right. So again, it depends on, you know, so our galaxy has a 10 to the minus 6 potential. It's in a local group. It's in a large-scale structure. So with a little bit of play, maybe a few 10 to the minus 6 to 10 to the minus 5, but no more than that. So cosmological constraints are not yet there. The cluster constraints are at 10 to the minus 4. But I would say once it gets to 10 to the minus 5, it's getting competitive. So it's getting to a point where ambiguities like whether we are in a deeper gravitational potential than just our isolated halo would tell us those sorts of ambiguities make it valuable to do the cosmological test as complements.
Can you jump, please?
Just comment on the question. There is a competitive cosmological model called the void cosmology. There's no acceleration. Dark energy is not there. The lambda is too. Remember the Copernican principle is also violated in the CEM model. It's temporal. This is from.
Oh, sure.
Both of those are violated because
we live in a special time. Yes.
The question is how natural, how unnatural, how contrived. How provoke
there are these lines from as lambda
so that you can fit the solar system data and all the cosmological data?
They're at least as contrived as lambda CDM. Whether they're more contrived in quintessence, I don't know. Whether you like a 10 to the minus 33 EV mass and how you can protect that, that is debatable, but it's certainly not any better than lambda CDM for any coincidence problem or any time-beating problem. That's right.
But it's worse, isn't it?
It's almost certainly worse than the CDM. Yeah.
Okay.
Questionable whether it's worse than quintessence. Mm.
Sure. So is this a follow-up on this?
Okay. So you mentioned this 5 sigma deviation of UGP when you use a supernova plus ISW. So this long supernova, they can get a totally different result. This is different, right? What happens if you throw away the supernova or if you use that light core feature that gives the GP as a recipe? How much does it change?
I think it's still a tension. I mean, I think if you wanted to have, so you could of course have RC so large that you don't get any cosmic acceleration and throw back a cosmological constant. But basically, we'd have to do the quantitative thing, but I think it's still in tension. We saw that really, if I wanted to use a model that best fits like a union data set, I would actually have a quadrupole of the CMB that was of order the first peak in the microwave background, so nowhere near the observations. And it's only by adjusting it and making it a 5-sigma problem for a supernova that the maximum likelihood model had something halfway to the first peak in terms of the amplitude. So it's a big problem, is what I'm saying, if you want anything where RC was of order the Hubble parameter.
I look for the self-accelerating branch. Mm-hmm. My recollection is of the delta chi square that gives you 5 sigma. I think only along a third of it comes from the analyzer.
Yeah, it depends on how you separate it out. I mean, it's a tension that you can shove in the supernovae part or in the CMB part. So it's hard to say, how to put it on one and compromise.
So why do you keep on saying that F of R is a pi model? Because if you go about modifying action, you really don't have that much freedom. So
yeah, it may have problems on the particle physics level. So we want to add something where at finite field we get infinite curvature. That is not going to be, probably not going to work for quantum corrections for that potential. So they're going beyond this Newtonian classical level. It may not work as a full theory.
Yeah, moreover, as I was saying before, there is no motivation why it stays of the form of R. In the sense, if you start with it, it's a scalar field coupled with matter. And that's it. The reason why it stays in this particular form of FOR, I don't think the rather is stable.
Yeah.
You're saying f of r is a very special form of scalar tensor.
Yeah, because there is a single function. Instead of a coupling with matter and the potential is a single function makes it.
I'd love to talk with you about that. I was struggling with whether it was a conformal anomaly, but anyway.
I think Tiff Burgess thinks that it's a conformal anomaly, I remember, but maybe somebody else here knows more than. But I mean, if it's just a scalar field, it could couple differently to different things, and there could be Bohr's problems. Then.
Can you protect the universal
yeah.
coupling?
Exactly.
I think that what Paolo mentioned is actually not quite the universal coupling. It's just the fact that you know, in F of R, in Jordan frame, there's no kinetic term in the scalar field. The fact that that is true, I think that you don't even need conformal at all. That is just not just work out the quantum parameters. You will produce a kinetic.
I'd like to talk to you more about it.
So I have a different question. So the DTP model, actually any modified gravity model, you have an extra scalar degree of freedom, basically, which there isn't in general relativity. So in principle, you have to set the initial conditions somehow for this extra scalar, right?
Right.
So how would you go about doing that?
Right. So in these examples, we set it close to GR. That is, it's got a minimum in the potential, and there's a damping term, but we demand that it doesn't have enough kinetic energy in the initial conditions to shoot you out of the minimum.
But for something like DGP, it seems to me that there is no potential in it that gives you that.
Oh, that's right. Yeah, DGP is a different story. I don't think there is any freedom in DGP.
But isn't there? Because I mean, the brain bending mode, it seems that it can have arbitrary initial conditions, like the brain.
Yeah, it's mainly the spatial structure and the spatials, unless you were doing something.
No, but it's just the position of the brain in the extra dimension. It's arbitrary. It could be anywhere. Like if in one Hubble pad, it could be here, another Hubble pad, it could be here. And on sub-horizon scales, I guess it damps, but on super-horizon scales, it seems arbitrary.
Just that's like saying that it's arbitrary with the initial conditions for what the density in different Hubble patches will be.
But it's in addition to density.
You're just assuming isotropy.
You're assuming everything is sourced by the fluctuations on the brain.
But I mean, just whatever sets your initial conditions for all cosmologies.
But it seems that there's more than one degree of freedom. There's the position of the brain and there's the density on the brain.
You're saying there's no justification for adiabaticity of supernova? Your question.
Unless, or maybe you have a justification for adiabaticity.
In the usual, if you have a single source of perturbation, it will be
adiabatic. Yeah, I mean, the only way I can think of violating that is to have the brain bending mode not being dominantly sourced by the matter.
On super horizon scale, you're saying the bending mode is sourced by the matter? Because
in these calculations, yes.
But it seems to me on super horizon scales, brain could be anywhere. Independent of the matter density.
So we're assuming it starts off in a nearly FRW state, right?
We should test. Let's kind of weigh in again.